At colleges and universities all around the country, around this time of year, students are picking up their diplomas and they're heading out into the world with skills and experiences that they hope will set them up for life, at least will make it possible for them to realize their dreams and have careers. But as they head out, not only will they be taking with them what they learned at the university, many of them will be taking with them significant debt. And that seems to be a growing problem, one that gives us cause to worry. More than 90% of today's students earning a bachelor's degree, in fact, borrow money to pay for school. And that can leave them with some significant debts when they graduate. The question is, why is it that so many students have turned to borrowing to pay for college? And what happens to them, what happens to the country, if they can't repay their loans? In this part of Focus, we'll be talking with a nationally recognized expert on student loans and financial aid. Her name is Lauren Asher, and she is president of the Institute for College Access and Success. This is a nonprofit organization that's interested in making higher education more available and affordable for people of all backgrounds. It's also the home to the Project on Student Debt, something that our guest co-founded in 2005. We'll try to take a look at the problem of student debt, get some sense of it, and talk about why it has happened and some of the long-term implications in this part of the show. And Ms. Asher, hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me, David.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. Just to start out, maybe we could talk about some numbers.
Sure.
What is now the total debt, the total student debt, higher education student debt in this country?
Well, outstanding student debt, meaning student loans, both federal and private, that have not yet been paid off, is at about $1 trillion.
Now, that I have seen that figure cited in many articles. I think there are some people who wonder whether that might be a tiny bit high, although even then when you ask those people, they say, well, maybe it's only like 800 million, which is still a pretty big number. Do you feel that that's you're fairly confident in that number, that $1 trillion number?
Well, there are more than 800 million in just federal loans outstanding.
Uh-huh.
So we know it's higher than that. The estimate of about $1 trillion comes from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which has been doing a very deep research project at the request of Congress into the private loan industry. And there is a chance that it's a little low yet or a little high, but my guess is it's about right.
Right. And it is, and the bulk of it is indeed has been in the form of loans issued by and owed to the federal government.
That's correct. Private student loans are a part of the overall picture of student debt, but they're very, very different financial products. In 2008, about 14% of undergraduates overall had these non-federal or private loans. The difference is that they don't come with any of the repayment plans, forgiveness plans, or borrower protections that come with federal student loans. So they're one of the riskiest ways to pay for college. It's not just how much you owe, but what kinds of loans you have that really affect how burdensome your debt is.
Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose perhaps this is something of a side question, but that invites the question, why would anybody borrow money, go out to the private market to borrow money if they could borrow it from the federal government and have more favorable terms?
It's a great question, and we were very disturbed when we analyzed the data and found that more than half of all undergraduates with private loans had not maxed out on their federal loan eligibility. And we wondered the same thing. Why is that? Last year, we went and interviewed financial aid directors at a whole range of colleges around the country and said, why do you think people are turning to private loans, and what do you do when you find out that they're applying for them? We got very different kinds of answers. But overall, they said one of the biggest problems is that people don't realize that they're eligible for federal loans. They think there's an income cap, and there is no income cap. Or they think there's a deadline that's the same as the financial aid deadline for their school, when in fact you can apply for federal grants and loans throughout the school year. There are a variety of other reasons as well. Sometimes people don't realize the difference between a variable rate loan and a fixed rate loan. And we saw what happened with that in the mortgage crisis, and to some degree we see similar confusion, as well as very aggressive and often deceptive marketing that was taking place before the credit crunch of these private loan products.
What is the average owed?
Well, it's a great question as well. We do know that for the class of 2010, which is the most recent data available, that for graduates of public and private nonprofit colleges, about two-thirds had debt when they graduated, and their average debt was $25,250.
Hmm. And that is the average. So, and I'm sure that right away people say, well, okay, so that's the average. So how about what's it look like on the higher end and the lower end? And let us say how many people owe more than $50,000 or perhaps less than 10?
Well, the best data we have for that is actually for the class of 2008. The federal government doesn't collect debt at graduation for colleges at the college level. We turn to private surveys that ask colleges to voluntarily report, and about half of public and private nonprofit colleges do every year. I can tell you that in 2008, 1 in 10 college graduates with loans had $40,000 in debt or more, but less than 1% had $100,000 or more.
Okay, so 1 in 10, $40,000 or more, and less than 1% were over $100,000.
Correct.
Okay, and there, I'm sure we're talking about people who are in the professions.
So no, we're talking about undergraduates here, people with 4-year degrees.
Okay, I'm just thinking of the people at the higher end. I was thinking, maybe that's wrong, but I was thinking, well, that would be people who were had been through med school or law school.
No, these are just people who completed a 4-year degree.
There are people who have completed a 4-year undergraduate degree that end up owing $100,000?
Very few, but yes. And they often show up in the headlines because it's very alarming. And that $100,000 is going to include private loans, which is part of why it can be so hard to manage, mm-hmm. in addition to the big number.
Well, then the next question, I suppose, next natural question is, and if you look over time, you can see that the percentage of students who borrow money for school, let us say over about the last 20 years, has grown significantly to the point now where it seems that, at least according to what I read, we're getting close to everybody.
Well, there's a lot of discussion of that 94%.
Yeah,
it was in the
yeah,
New York
tell
Times.
Me, but yes, that's where I got it. Yeah.
And the field I'm in, lots and lots of discussion. It's not actually a representative figure. It's mm-hmm. a number. It's a percentage of another percentage of first-year full-time students. In fact, it's about two-thirds of all 4-year college grads who have loans.
Okay.
And that has held relatively steady for the last several years. But their average debt is rising at about 5% a year. If you look back to 1993, you see that less than half of all 4-year college graduates had loans, and they owed much, much less. Without controlling for inflation, in 93, the less than half of 4-year grads with loans had an average of less than $10,000 in debt. In 2004, it reached about two-thirds of college grads with loans. Their average debt was a little under $20,000. Now we're still at around two-thirds, but it's more than $25,000.
Okay. So what's important here is, again, if you go back to the early 90s, less than half of the undergraduates had loans, and now we're looking at two-thirds mm-hmm. have loans. And so not only is the numbers of students who have borrowed money gone up, but the amount of money that they owe
correct.
Has also gone up.
That's right.
Okay. So now the question, why? Why has this happened?
Well, here's the short answer. College costs have outpaced both family incomes and available grant aid for quite a while now. And student loans are what people turn to fill that growing gap.
Mm. And that is, I know I'm most familiar, I suppose, with the kind of things that public school administrators talk about. I'm not quite sure what private schools, what their situation is, but you have just said exactly what they will tell you, and that it has to do with the fact that states don't support their state institutions the way that they did. The institutions feel that, you know, they have to maintain their facilities, they have to keep their best faculty, and they say the only alternative that they have, if the state is not going to support the institution, is to turn around and reach into the pocket of students and increase tuition.
Well, indeed, the large majority of undergraduates go to public colleges and universities, and that's where the costs that are passed on to students and families, which are the costs that people are really thinking about, are directly affected by what happens in the state budget. And those dynamics go well beyond what's happening in the higher education world, but states still make decisions about how to allocate whatever resources they have, and then colleges make decisions about how to allocate their own budget. Public colleges have varying degrees of independence in how they budget themselves, both how much money they have for financial aid and who gets that money.
Mm-hmm. Well, now this is this gets us into another area and a perfectly good set of questions, but they're a little bit different about colleges and how they contain cost and the fact that they're going to have to start. They can't just continue to raise tuition year after year. And colleges and universities and their administrators know that perfectly well.
Well, research by the Delta Cost Project has shown that the share of the total cost of providing an education that is passed on to students and families has grown much faster than the total cost of providing that education. So there's the cost of providing an education at a public college, and then there's how much of that cost students and families are expected to cover. It's that latter piece that has grown much faster.
Let me just very quickly introduce the guest for anyone who's just tuned in. We're talking with Lauren Asher. She is president of the Institute for College Access and Success. This is a nonprofit organization that's interested in the affordability of higher education. She is a nationally recognized expert on student loans and financial aid. And we are talking about the problem of student loan debt. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 and toll free, 800-222-9455. Do you think that, first of all, I think that some people are arguing that we do have a problem here in that money is much too available. It's much too easy to get. And so do you think that it's possible that because loans are available, that people are borrowing money and they are going to colleges that they wouldn't have been able to go to before, or they're getting degrees that they wouldn't have been able to go through or wouldn't be able to do without the loans, and that they're doing that without thinking carefully enough about what their prospects are when they finish and whether or not they'll really be able to pay that loan back?
Well, student loans have been widely available for a long time from the federal government, and because they're a form of financial aid, they not only don't discriminate among borrowers, except that you have to be a U.S. citizen or legal resident and meet a few other basic requirements. There's no credit check for most federal student loans. They also come with a variety of protections, and those protections have improved in recent years, and we can talk about that in a little bit. There isn't any evidence that the availability of student aid is driving cost. The Pell Grant, for instance, was stagnant for many years and is now only worth about a third of what it costs to go to a four-year public college on average, its lowest value in history, yet costs continued to rise well beyond that. Student loan limits were stagnant for quite a while. We didn't see a similar stagnation in college costs. When student loan limits went up several years ago, the only place you really saw a shift that seemed to correlate was in the for-profit college sector.
Mm-hmm. Well, does if we have two-thirds of students having loans, does that contribute to, might that contribute to a feeling on the part of students that, well, that's just what we do. We borrow money to go to school, and is that potentially a problem?
Well, at community colleges, less than 15% of students borrow. At for-profit colleges, nearly all students borrow. Mm. At public colleges, about 62% of graduates have loans. Mm. It really varies. I think a lot of people are surprised at how much borrowing is happening at public colleges and universities, and that's very much a reflection of this changing set of expectations that policymakers have about how college is going to be paid for. No one really sat down and said, let's redesign our higher education finance system to rely much more heavily and indefinitely on more and more student borrowing. We find ourselves in this position. It's part of why we founded the Project on Student Debt in 2005, was to start calling attention to a really dramatic trend that hadn't really gotten a name. And I think people felt very alone with their debt and their concerns. What we see just as much is people making decisions to avoid or limit borrowing that actually reduce their chance of completing a degree. And completion is the best predictor of your ability to repay your loans. So if you go part-time instead of full-time, if you go to a two-year school when you're qualified for a four-year school, if you work more than 20 hours a week while you're in school for full-time, these are all choices people make to try and contain their overhead, and at the same time, they consistently, through research, are shown to reduce your odds of ever completing. So on the one hand, you have debt avoidance that can undermine success, although it can also help people shop around and find a good deal. There are lots of good deals out there. In fact, Illinois has one of the lowest debt schools that report their debt. It's Governor State, where 58% of students borrow by the time they graduate, and their average debt is less than $3,000. And this school serves a very large share of low-income students.
Mm-hmm.
So it's complicated. Certainly, sometimes people borrow more than they realize or more than they've been able to conceive of what it would mean if they had to pay it back. Some people borrow based on expectations of future earnings that no one can guarantee. College is still a great investment on average, but like any investment, the return isn't guaranteed. And that's why if you do borrow, you should shop around to make sure you're getting a decent deal and make sure you only borrow federal loans.
We have a couple of callers. Let's bring them in. We'll start with someone in Charleston, and that's line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I understand that what I'm about to ask is probably a minor aspect of this situation, but I'm really curious whether there's some data. I teach it down here at Eastern Illinois University, which is a pretty moderately priced school. I've done a lot of academic advising, so I've talked with a lot of students, and one thing that I've noticed is that even though we are a pretty moderately priced school, very few of my students have done any saving prior to coming to college. And so semester to semester, they're thinking about how they're paying each semester. And again, with rising costs, I understand that it may be very difficult to save for college, but I wonder if there has been a trend for less saving over time for college. And the other thing that I've noticed is that the same students who have no savings to work towards paying for college do have cars that they've been given as graduation presents. And, you know, I hear people complain, I know maybe we're just old curmudgeonly professors, but I hear people complain that students have a very high expectation of their state of living while they're in college. And so I'm wondering if there's any data on those kinds of trends as well.
I haven't seen any specific data on that, and I'll say I'm not an expert on the college savings side of the package. I do know that far more people and people of different economic backgrounds are going to college than used to. So you've got a lot of people coming from households that don't have any assets and therefore probably don't have the option of saving. I think an interesting fact is when you look at Pell Grant recipients, and Pell Grants only go to people with generally an income of $50,000 or less, the vast majority less than $40,000, they are much more likely, they're more than twice as likely to have loans than other undergraduates. And when they do complete a four-year degree, they owe more. There's a big gap between available grant aid and what it costs to get through school. Certainly you'll find examples of people who aren't living the way we expect students to live, but you also find a lot of examples of people who are struggling desperately and cobbling together multiple jobs and multiple buses to get to and from school.
Sure, and I don't mean to deny that there are students who are genuinely struggling to get through school. I was just curious whether we know anything about college savings generally.
I wish I could tell you more. There are, you know, vehicles that have emerged over the years through the tax system, like the 529 plans. Those generally tend to work better for people who have a decent amount of disposable income to begin with.
Right.
When you look at the expectations of student earnings that go into a lot of financial aid packages, they're often quite high, especially in an environment like this. So student work is actually pretty common in high school and very common in college. More than 80% of students do work while they're in school.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks.
All right, Sure. Thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Are you at all familiar, generally speaking, with the health of 529 plans across the country?
Except that I have a 4.5-year-old, and we talk about it a lot at home. I'm not.
Okay. The only reason I ask the question is because our own plan here in Illinois is not in good shape. And it would seem that what happened was that the people who were, you know, administrating and formulating the plan did not anticipate just how fast the tuition costs would go up. And so that seems to be the problem. And I just was wondering, well, what's been the experience of other states across
the
country?
Is that a prepaid plan?
Yes.
A 529 plan is a tax advantage.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I'm confused.
I say it's even confusing for me in my capacity as a parent. But there are also in some states some prepaid plans that lock in a rate for college that turns out, as you say, in some cases, not
viable. Yes, that's the problem. Okay. Well, in any case, questions, welcome again, 333-WILL. You can also send us an email, and that's will-talk@illinois.edu. Someone is listening here, and I got an email from someone just sort of to clarify this point that when you were talking about borrowing, I think that you were suggesting people that it's a much better way to go if you're going to borrow, that you borrow from the federal government than if you borrow from a private lender.
Correct.
And the person was just wondering, maybe you can again say, well, why is that? Why would you say that you would suggest to people that they stay away from private loans?
Certainly. Private loans are one of the riskiest ways to pay for college. They're a lot like credit cards. They generally have variable rates that have no cap, the same with fees. And they're not required to carry any of the repayment plans, loan forgiveness programs, and borrower protections that come with federal student loans, such as income-based repayment, which since 2009 allows anyone with federal student loans to apply to get their payment capped based on their income and family size. It will adjust each year. And if after 25 years you still owe anything, it's forgiven. In some cases, if you work for a public or nonprofit employer, it could be forgiven after 10 years of these payments. There are also unemployment deferments, in-school deferments, forbearances without fees, cancellation in the case of severe disability or the borrower's death. None of these things are required with private loans. They have a lot more in common with credit cards or, in some cases, with the exploding mortgages that were around before the bubble burst. They also are not dischargeable in bankruptcy. They're treated like federal loans since 2005, even though they're entirely different products with no taxpayer interest. So really, the problem with private loans is, in addition to unpredictable costs, you're at the mercy of your lender if anything goes wrong, like graduating in the middle of a recession.
Okay. I hope that gets at the question of the caller. We do have somebody else here on the phone. We want to bring them in here. This is somebody on cell phone on our line 4. Hello? Yes. Hello.
Hi. I live in Madison, Wisconsin. Of course, University of Wisconsin is there. And I recently heard a kind of startling statistic that a very high number of kids there major in political science or the like, sociology and so on. And now, I don't regard political science as either political or science, and I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on the choice of major or these kind of worthless majors that kids are choosing, and then their ability to pay back these loans. Thanks very much.
All right. Well, if there are some political scientists out there listening, they might want to question the idea that would be a worthless major. But, you know, we'll leave that to them. I don't know. Is there anything that you can say about that?
Well, in fact, it seems to there are some majors that are more likely to generate quick higher earnings than others. Although, if you look back, say right before the tech bubble burst in around 2000, people who were majoring in computer science were assured that they would graduate and get a job, a very well-paying job right out of school, and then things changed, and they were competing for much less well-paying jobs. My understanding is that petroleum engineers generally don't have too hard a time finding work, although it's also an extraordinarily rigorous undergraduate program. Liberal arts degrees translate into all kinds of jobs, and people generally are pursuing them not because they are expecting to be prepared for a specific career as a politician, let's say, but for broader educational purposes. So as a liberal arts major myself, I don't think it's quite so cut and dry.
We are talking in this hour of focus about the issue of student loan debt. And our guest is Lauren Asher. She is a nationally recognized expert on student loans and financial aid. She's the president of the Institute for College Access and Success, which is a nonprofit group that's interested in making higher education more available and affordable. She is also co-founder of the Project on Student Debt, which is based there at the Institute, and she co-founded back in 2005. Back to the phones here. We have somebody in the Quad Cities. Line number one. Hello.
Hi. Yes. Lauren, thanks for taking my call. And my experience goes back a few years, but when I started college in 1958, it was possible for me to pay the entire cost of a year of college with a decent summer job. Well, as you know, one would be very, very lucky and have to have an awfully good job these days in order to do that. And what I'm going to put my finger here on is the problem is inflation and the cost of higher education. Do you think that something could be done about the tremendous inflation we've seen over the last 45 years in what college costs? I mean, I look at a professor at the University of Illinois, or like they dismissed their president up over there recently, and I look at the amount of money he was getting while he was president, and then they make him a professor, and I don't quite understand why these people need to be paid over $100,000 a year, and that and any number of things. For example, here in the Quad Cities, we have a private college, and I look at the richness of the dormitories that have just been constructed for these students, and I'm thinking, you know, the cost of higher education, the inflation, it has to do with an awful lot of things that have increased way out of proportion to what they need to be.
Well, I think these are very common questions, and while I'm not an expert on how colleges structure their budgets per se, we focus mostly on the financial aid piece. There's no question that there's a lot of variation in what colleges are offering and in what they're charging, and they don't always line up. You talked about a minimum wage job over the summer. 20 years ago, a minimum wage job full-time during the summer, part-time during the school year, would more than cover tuition and fees, in many cases would also cover all your living costs. That is simply not the case today. It has something to do with how the minimum wage has evolved, but it has more to do with how those costs have evolved. So you could have the same hardworking student from the same background having to borrow today to get through school. We go back to the earlier part of the discussion, which is not just the cost of providing the education and what colleges are spending money on, but how much of that cost is covered by the state. And that is where the really big difference is, as well as the value of grant aid. The Pell Grant in the 1980s covered on average more than half of the cost of going to a public college or university. In the 70s, it covered nearly 75%. Now it's less than a third.
Well, and just to add to what I told you, I never, ever had to work a job while I was in school during the school year, and I never took out a loan. And, in fact, I started college with about $1,000 in the bank, and I ended college with that $1,000 still in the bank.
Well, good for you. I wish that were the case for more students today, although we do need to note that about a third of four-year college graduates do leave school without student loan debt.
Well, obviously, if your parents are well-funded or have large incomes, you're not going to have to borrow, and you probably have it made. But in my day, you could pay for room, board, and tuition at a state university for $800 or $900.
Can I just ask the caller, just out of curiosity, what year was it that you graduated?
From college?
Yes.
In 1962. And then I took my master's in 63 and financed it the same way. No debt.
Okay.
Well,
but
we
I'm
look
just
at
pointing the out the fact that you have taken the. I mean, why do you think college costs have exceeded even the inflation in medical care? I mean, something's wrong when the inflation has increased to that degree. I mean, we may have an awful lot of overpaid people at those institutions.
Well, that's. I think this may be something of a topic for another day. With a different kind of a guest, but I do appreciate, you know, the comments of the caller. I do, though. I guess I want to ask this question, and again, it's sort of a difficult question, but the numbers seems to be clear, or they have been clear for some time now, that people who graduate from college do better financially for the rest of their life than people who don't. At the same time, it seems that now, because there is so much discussion about the cost of a college education and the level of student debt, that people are starting to question the value of a college education. What about that?
That's true. I get that question a lot, and I think it's a good question for people to be asking. The answer, like a lot of things, is it depends. For instance, when you look at the for-profit college sector, where virtually everyone is expected to borrow, and they tend to borrow more and default at much higher rates, they account for about 10% of all student enrollment, but nearly half of all student loan defaults. The return on investment is much less clear. The investment expected of the student and the taxpayer is quite high. The return on average is pretty low. When you look at some schools that have high sticker prices, you'll find that they don't necessarily have high debt. Or schools that may not have a lot of resources but allocate their financial aid to try and limit borrowing for at least their low-income students. There's just a tremendous range. You can't predict the debt pattern of a school just by looking at its sticker price. And in fact, the net price, which is the total cost of attendance, tuition and fees, plus books and housing and food and transportation, minus grants and scholarships, has on average gone down over the last year at public and nonprofit colleges, but gone up at for-profit colleges.
I have an email here, and again, this is it's an interesting point. It's slightly different issue. I don't know if this is something that you can talk about, but I just do want to air the comments of the person who wrote in, who essentially said that he believes that all this conversation about the cost of an education means that the educational model that we have now is ripe for change. And in fact, he writes this: the residential model seems to be a large part of the expense. And he's someone who is now taking advantage of online opportunities that exist. And he says that he thinks that online alternatives are going to revolutionize college moving forward, because it makes it possible for you to get an education at a fraction of the cost. And you can do that but living one place and getting your schooling at another and do it online. And I wonder what you think about that.
Well, it really depends on what you're paying for that online course and how it is factored in by the types of institutions you want to complete a degree at or the kinds of places you want to work. I think there's no question that people are questioning the model and they're questioning the pricing, and that those are healthy things to question. Clearly, the current trends can't continue without some shift. We can't expect people to just borrow more and more and more. We can't expect costs to just keep going up and up and up. Nobody knows where the tipping point is. But it's important that whether you're taking a course online or on a campus, you need at least a couple of hours, according to research, two or three, in addition to each hour of class time for study, interaction with other students and professors, to do well in a class and get the benefit of the investment of your time as well as your money. So when we think about the cost of education, you can't just look at the tuition and fees. That's just what gets you in the door. To actually complete the course and move forward, you do need to cover some of those other costs.
We're talking this morning, again, in this part of Focus, with Lauren Asher. She's president of the Institute for College Access and Success. She is someone who is a nationally recognized expert on the subject of student loans and financial aid. And if you have questions, that's what we're talking about here this morning. Questions, comments, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. You know, one, I came across this statistic, and it was just kind of jaw-dropping, and I was hoping that you could help me understand it a little bit, and that is that, and this, again, is this comes from the, I think it's the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, where some of the statistics we have come from, and that is that Americans age 60 and over collectively owe $36 billion in student loans. And I just thought, what? And so then obviously the question here is, well, is that people who later in life decided to go back to school and borrow money? Is that people who actually, this is money that was borrowed for the benefit of children or grandchildren? Or could it possibly be that some of these people still have student loans when they were in college as undergraduates?
Unfortunately, the data don't tell us very much about what the reason for borrowing was or the timing of the loan. My guess is it's all of the above. Mm. In some cases, they might be parents who took out loans on behalf of their children for their education. In some, it might be people who went to graduate school or went back to undergraduate later in life. And we can't tell. Unfortunately, the data don't break down that way. And particularly for private loans, there's almost no federal data. They have to base it on credit reports and some sampling. I think it's really interesting to look at just how many people are borrowing at different stages of life. Student loans have become a fact of life for more and more Americans. That same study found that about 37 million Americans have outstanding student loan debt across the age spectrum. And that's pretty striking. So probably all of us know somebody with student loans if we ourselves don't have them. And that's part of why this important public conversation is happening. I think as they have become more and more pervasive and are lasting longer in people's lives, there's a more of a sense of urgency about how to mitigate the risks and address some of the drivers.
Yeah. Well, this, I suppose, brings us to the one of the big questions, and that is, with this astounding outstanding debt, $1 trillion in debt, do we really think that that money will be repaid? Or perhaps the question is, at what percentage of that money do we think one way or another we're going to have to write off?
Well, I wish there were an easy answer to that question. I think just for perspective, that $1 trillion is less than a tenth of outstanding mortgage debt in the country. Mm-hmm. And it's a very different type of debt for a very different type of product. You can't resell your education, or you can't legally. The loans are also structured very differently. So since the large majority of that is in federal student loans, those loans come with extraordinarily strong collection powers on behalf of the federal mm-hmm. government. And those include no statute of limitations on collections.
I believe that we've lost our guest. I'll tell you what, here's a good opportunity for me to reintroduce, and we'll put the call back again, and we hope that we can get her back. We're talking in this part of Focus about the problem of student loan debt and default, and whether or not this amounts to a national crisis. And the guest for the program is Lauren Asher. She's president of the Institute for College Access and Success. This is a nonprofit organization that's interested in making higher education more available and affordable for people of all backgrounds. It's also home to something called the Project on Student Debt, which our guest, Ms. Asher, co-founded back in 2005. So questions here are welcome. We'll be here for about another 10 minutes or so. And we'd be very happy to take questions and comments in the form of phone calls, 333-9455, or you can also send us an email if you want. And that's will-talk@illinois.edu. And Ms. Asher, I think we have you back, I hope.
Yes, you do.
Okay. Anyway, so I guess the question that I had just asked and you were approaching was indeed this big question about this big outstanding debt. You know, what possibility is that there will be people that won't be able to pay it back, and what do we think that might amount to?
Sure. I'm sorry for that technical problem at my end. As I was saying, federal student loans come with extraordinary collection powers on behalf of the federal government. Mm-hmm. If you default on a federal student loan, your credit rating is ruined, which can affect your ability to get a loan to buy a car or rent an apartment or even in some cases get a job because credit reports are used more and more in employment. You can have your wages garnished, your tax refunds reclaimed, and even part of your Social Security tax taken back. So there are a lot of good reasons to be careful about borrowing. At the same time, federal loans come with a lot of options for managing that debt, for stretching out payments, which means more interest over time for the borrower, for forgiveness programs under certain conditions. They are a form of student aid, so they are an investment by the federal government in making sure that people have access to the resources that they need to get an education if they don't come from families that can pay for it out of pocket, which is more and more of the college-going population. So certainly there are concerns about degrees of delinquency and default with federal loans, but there also are a lot of tools for collection. They are not automatically discharged when you qualify for bankruptcy. And I think as we find more and more people learning about things like income-based repayment, which allows you to manage your debt based on what you can actually afford, most will still pay it off before they reach that 25-year point for forgiveness. But for those who can't, there's a way to resolve the remaining amount, which is still a much lower cost to the taxpayer than a default. Now, for private loans, which are a much smaller share of outstanding debt, but a much, much riskier part, the federal government doesn't have a stake, except to the degree that people who default on those loans are unlikely to be able to pay off their federal loans. Private loan default can also ruin you in many ways financially, but the taxpayer's money isn't at stake.
We have a couple of other callers here. We'll try to get them in, and time remains. We'll go next to someone in Champaign in line one. Hello.
Hello. This is very interesting. We talk about, and I heard the guest talk about return on investment. That is the high cost of soaring cost of college and the return on investment in terms of a job, which is vital. I'm not doubting that. My concern, and I read a book. I think Bob McChesley on Sunday may have had one of the co-authors on, Mr. Arum, who wrote a book, Academically Adrift: Little Learning in Higher Education. And the main critique, especially in the undergraduate, was that even in the best of colleges, even the U of I, for example, there is very little critical thinking, rigorous reasoning, and high writing standards that result from a college education, albeit it is higher priced than ever. I look at that as a very important factor in this return on investment. We're spending all this money, and yet more and more of our students at the undergraduate level are not well educated in terms of thinking, reasoning, and writing. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, the measures of student learning are not my area of expertise, but I'm familiar with the general threads of the book. And I think what's interesting is when you look at what happens when you do and don't have a degree in the economy. For instance, for young adults, those with a four-year degree were looking at unemployment rates less than half of what those who just had a high school degree had at the end of last year. And on average, lifetime earnings are much higher with a degree. Now, what that degree represents to employers, what it represents intellectually, undoubtedly varies tremendously as colleges and students vary. So no one can say for sure whether those who complete degrees started the process pretty well prepared to begin with or gained a tremendous amount through the process. Regardless, a degree is a signal in the economy of having accomplished something that seems to have value.
All right. Again, I hope that gets to the question of the caller. Let's go on to another. Terre Haute, Indiana, line number two. Hello.
Hello. I teach at the college level, and every semester I run into this paradox where I have students who are clearly struggling or even where it's reached the point where it's mathematically impossible for them to pass the class, and yet these students don't drop the class because of student loan requirements that they be full-time students. And it's, I think that when I have a student who is really struggling, I suspect that student is also probably at risk in some of their other classes. And I think that we would have a better chance of that student succeeding if they could focus attention on classes where, so if they could back down a notch and focus their energies on some classes where they can succeed instead of having to stay in mine when they might fail and even when I know I'm going to have to fail them. And so I find this to be sort of a paradox, almost like really dooming somebody, because then if they accumulate a number of these bad grades, then they're either going to have a worse transcript or they're not going to finish. And I understand it might get to the point where they have trouble getting new loans if they have a bad student record. And so I don't know what the answer to that is, but I feel like students who have maybe more backing from other resources are able to make what might be a better pedagogical choice to drop some classes. Do you have any thoughts on that? Is there an answer? And I'll listen on the radio.
All right.
Thank you.
Well, I can give you some factual information. One is that student loan eligibility does not depend on being enrolled full-time. So there may be some misinformation there. Another is that the Pell Grant is prorated so that you do need to be enrolled at least half-time to get a federal student loan, so what's considered 6 credits or more. For Pell Grants, it's prorated based on your enrollment, so you might get a smaller Pell Grant if you're enrolled in fewer classes. But there's also something called satisfactory academic progress, which I think is what you were referring to. There's a rule that says if you're not making adequate academic progress, you're not qualified for more federal aid until you can prove that you're meeting those minimum standards. So there are challenges for students, I think, in just getting clear information about federal aid eligibility. It's complicated. It's more complicated than it should be to figure out. Some colleges don't have a lot of resources for financial aid advising and also don't have a lot of communication between the academic side where you're observing these problems and the student services side where financial aid is housed. So that kind of variation can really affect students in some unfortunate ways. And we also see that coming out of the K-12 system, an awful lot of students are not college ready. And if they're at open admission institutions, they may well be bringing in the need for a lot of remediation and hopefully is getting assessed. But that's an area where there's a lot of research going on to figure out how better to help students who are behind the curve when they start get to the right point before it's too late.
And again, we'll go on to another caller. This is line 3 in Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello. Pardon me. There has been mention of public and for-profit schools, and this seems to me to have left out one group who are neither public in the usual sense, nor are they strictly speaking for profit, and that's the private schools. And I think it needs to be broken down more. It seems to me the University of Phoenix isn't the same as Harvard or even Wabash, but you seem to be lumping them together. The other thing, which is more important, I suppose, is it seems to me that education has more than one purpose. Certainly it's to enable a student to find a job, but it seems to me equally important, and perhaps more important from a societal standpoint, is the education of informed citizens. And if there's one thing I think we do not have a surplus of in this country, it is well-educated citizens. Would you comment?
Hi, I'm sorry. I'm getting some interference on this end. I believe the second part of your question was...
that college, the experience should be more than just getting, you know, can you get a job, but is it turning out educated, responsible citizens? And his comment seemed to be was maybe we're not doing a very good job at that.
Sure, and I think, as I understand, let me address the first part of your question. I do mean to distinguish very clearly, and I'm sorry if I didn't, between private nonprofit colleges and for-profit colleges. Mm-hmm. For-profit colleges, on average, have the highest share of students with loans, the greatest debt, and the worst default rates. They're a different kind of creature, although the data that we have don't help us differentiate very well between those that might be serving students well and those that are not. But there's now a well-documented record of waste, fraud, and abuse at some of these schools and disturbing patterns around student outcomes. For instance, you're more likely to be unemployed or default on a student loan if you complete a two-year degree or a short-term certificate at a for-profit school than if you drop out of a similar program at a nonprofit or public school.
You know, my apologies here to you and the caller. I'm going to have to jump in. We're simply at the end of the time. We're going to have to stop with that. I also will say, of course, that people are interested in finding out more about the Institute for College Access and Success. They do have a website. Our guest, Lauren Asher, is president. You can go there and take a look at it. And Ms. Asher, we want to say to you, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much.